You're listening to The Point. Anne LeClaire has a new novel out, The Halo Effect. It's a thriller that follows a father's search to find his daughter's killer and get revenge. Anne joins us in studio. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So this is kind of an interesting book in it. It is a murder mystery, kind of, but it's also about grief. And tell us how you put that together. I mean, we have lots of different kinds of grief going on in this story.
We do. We have a lot of different griefs going on in life. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, the last four books, I find when I'm done, I was writing about grief, but I don't know that going in. And I'm always interested, like when my publisher calls it a thriller or a mystery, because when I'm writing it, it doesn't feel like a mystery. It feels like I'm trying to write about people experiencing life situations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is Will Light. He's an internationally known artist. His daughter, Lucy, leaves for school one October morning, and she doesn't come home. Her body is found in the woods, and the police investigation has turned up nothing. So much of this story is about his grief and his wife, Sophie, and they grieve very differently, which, again, speaks to true life. People grieve differently. And it seems they each have a hard time understanding the way the other is grieving.
Well, don't you think that's true of life, that we put our own timetable on someone else's grief? Mm-hmm. I hear so many people say, I was told I should be over it by now, or get on with my life, and it's only been 6 months, and for some people it's been 5 years, and that's still where I am. And I think trying to understand, maybe the Victorians had it right, where there were signs that you were grieving and people, and there were official grief periods, and it's just murkier and more. I think of it as more kind of whispery now. In terms of not being something to you can kind of frame. Grief is just as you just said, so private and personal, and how we process it, and so to explore that. Yeah. And I think in married couples or in friends, everybody has their own way of processing. And some people it goes internally, some people it goes externally, some people try and find a meaning for things, and other people, like the revenge thing, mm-hmm. I think is, and I don't like to genderize, but I think there are differences in the way men and women handle certain things, and so I would like to explore that.
Yeah. Now, a lot of times you can see where a grief like this, I mean, losing a child, obviously a parent's worst nightmare. And in some cases, this could bring a couple closer together. And this case, this drives this couple, there's a lot of struggle going on in their relationship.
I had talked with therapists, and they said oftentimes there seem one of two ways. You're either going to be pulled closer together and bond in a through the horror of this, or it can fracture a marriage.
And Will also is struggling with a lot of anger, and that anger is he's losing control, let's say, in some situations. We're even surprising himself, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also thought this was a lot about violence in our culture and how we address that. And what beyond grief, I thought it was the violence that how it affects a community, how it affects a marriage, how it affects an individual. And there's something like more than well over 2,000 children a year are murdered in our culture. And yet we don't really hear that statistic a lot. But it affects a culture. And when someone in a town is murdered, it affects the town. It affects relationships. And I really wanted to explore that.
We also get the perspectives of two other characters, a local priest and then Lucy's best friend, Rain. Will's story is told in first person and the other two in third. Tell us about that.
Well, originally I thought it would be all Will's story, and I was good with that, and that was my plan. But the characters had other thoughts. And early on, I mean, before I even began the book, I knew the first sentence was, next they sent the priest. And I didn't know anything about the priest. I didn't know why they'd send a priest. That was the first, from the get-go, that was the first sentence of, not the preface, but the book itself. And very soon, the priest kept wanting to be in it. And I'm not Catholic, and I was very nervous about writing from the perspective of a priest. But he was quite insistent. And so then it just seemed like it was Will's story, but these two other voices, and also the town, mm-hmm. as the townspeople began to be the models for the saints, were like that Greek chorus, so that all of this could be told. But I thought we got a fuller picture of what had happened if there were two other voices intimately in the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Talk about character development, because your characters are so strong.
Oh, thank you. I love my characters. Even characters that readers don't like, I love, because I know why they are the way they are. And I think it's such a privilege to explore the mystery of the human heart and the contradictions we hold and the confusion of our heart and the way we are our own worst enemies so often, which was certainly the case for Will. And watching life, and I've been struck many times by people who have lost a child, and especially a child to murder. And I'm thinking of, remember the Charles Stewart case in Boston?
Yes, yes.
And the Carol DeMatte's parents, and that horrible thing of him accusing a black person of doing it. And what they ended up doing was starting a scholarship fund for underprivileged people in the black community in Boston to go to college. And they took something that was a horrific ripping of the fabric of their life and turned it into something good. And I thought, you have to have a huge heart to do that. Mm-hmm. And so with the two characters, Will and his wife, Sophie, it was like, where do you find the grace inside to have that huge heart? And can you grow to that place?
Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting because, you know, you talk about these different, you're not Catholic, yet you've got this priest who's a strong character. You've got, Will, who's a man, and these two different, people in the way they grieve. And then you've got Rain, who's a teenager. So now you've got the teenager head on. So you must have to do a lot of research to kind of come up with the expertise, so to speak, to speak in these voices.
Research for me is a permission to play, permission to be other people, permission to explore different ages, different outlooks, draw my own experience. I talked to a lot of therapists. There was one therapist in particular who deals with teenagers, and she was enormously helpful. I have three priests on speed dial. And there's a former priest in Chatham who read the book when I was working on it, and I would interview him about certain, is this the way they do it? And one of the guys who does my website is Catholic, and he said, he read it too in works, and he said, no, you've got an Episcopal thing they do there. Catholics don't do that. And so and I love to research, and I love to really think about what makes us tick and how we respond and why do we do the things we do.
All right, so let's talk a little about Rain. Rain cuts herself, mm-hmm. which is something that some teenagers actually do, and it's a really horrible thing to have to go through. Why did you want Rain to have to go through that?
Well, it's like, I know this kind of sounds schizophrenic when I talk about it, but it wasn't like I decided to have her do it. She decided mm-hmm. to do it. It's like who they are. They come in a way kind of fully. They come with their own baggage for me. Mm-hmm. I think the subconscious is so interesting as a writer, because so many times I write something and it just seemed like, oh, that day it just kind of fit in the plot or something, or just that's what would happen. And then five chapters later, I found that there's a whole reason why that happened, but I didn't know it when I was writing it. Hmm. But some part of me must have known.
Right.
So the cutting has, because I have friends who have family members who have, I know the pain of it, but also the desperate need to control some aspect of life.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you mentioned you talked to some therapists for the book. So was Dr. Mallory based on one of those therapists?
Not really, although after I'd written the scene, I would read her the scenes, because she liked to have me read them to her. And then she would say, oh, and one of the most charming things I think that in the book that Dr. Mallory did, this woman had said, well, at that point I might do this. And it was so perfect, I would just write it down.
All right, so Will is asked to paint portraits of saints for a new cathedral. And at first he wants nothing to do with this. For quite a while he wants nothing to do with this. And he changes his mind. Hmm? And the portraits are actually people from, uses the faces of people from the community. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, that's just centuries-old practice of using the townspeople as models. And all the great artists did that. And I had been watching TV one day before a Patriots game, and I was looking for pre-game hype, and I'm flicking through. And on one channel, there was an image so arresting, I stopped with the clicker and looked, and it was about a man in California, an artist named John Nava, who was commissioned to do a series of saints for the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Angels in L.A., and he used his townspeople as models. So it's an hour-long documentary, which we're going to be showing in Chatham on June 25th, Saturday morning. And I would see the pictures of the people in the town. There was a sculptor, there was a barista, there was a young boy, there was a fisherman. I mean, all these different people, because I think they're 30 total. And then it would show them as he saw them as saints. And it was just so beautiful to see the person, to see how he saw the saint in their the humanity of them. And it was just so beautiful. As it turned out, they didn't work in the cathedral because they needed something to muffle sound. So they actually turned his paintings into a computerized program, sent it to Bruges, Belgium, where they were made into these magnificent tapestries that hang there now. But I was so taken by this. And that night we had gone to the symphony. And as I'm sitting in the hall, I'm looking around and everyone looked like a saint to me. And I'd say to my husband, doesn't that person look like a saint? And doesn't that person... And then the next day I went to the market and I came back and said, the checkout clerk looked like a saint. And he goes, how long is this going to last?
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know. But Sarah Tennypacker, another author, is a friend of mine. And I was just telling her how, I said, it must have changed John Nava to start to see people as saints. And she said, I think you need to write about it. I said, no, I don't really need to write about it. It's just, I just am struck by it. And a week later, she said, have you started writing about it? I said, no, I'm not going to write about it, but I just can't stop thinking about him. And then I thought, what if you were that artist and one of the people you started to paint as a saint had done something unforgivable?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I was going to bring that up. Part two of the book, you start with a quote from Oscar Wilde. Every saint has a past and every sinner has a future.
Isn't that a great quote?
It is a great quote. But Will thinks a lot about the people that he's painting for these portraits and about everybody. I mean, everybody's a suspect in his mind. So talk about that inner struggle he's going through as, is this my daughter's killer?
Right. Well, see, the first part of the book, everyone he looked at when he'd go for his walks, actually looking into faces to see the possibility that that was the person who murdered his daughter. And I just loved how that can shift to from stopping to look at the potential for evil in a person's face to the humanity in a person's face. And when that happened for him and this shift and how the opening and the person who created that opening for him. And then what happens if we start to look at people around? Mm. How would the world be different if we really started to look at the people we met in every day and just try to see the softness, the humanity, the potential, whatever their place for, because the saints were us.
Mm-hmm. Right. So as I mentioned, it's a murder mystery, but not in a sense that you're not giving clues along the way. So we're not kind of solving this murder. It unfolds. That's a good way to put it. It's really more of a story of emotions and healing. And let's talk about the priest's role in this. He's struggling with his own grief.
I think we all are. I mean, if we're alive, we're grieving. There's
something. Different degrees. Yeah.
Different degrees, but life is a series of losses, and he certainly has. I grew to love the priest so much, Father Gervais. He just felt like a kind soul behind me the whole time I was writing the book. Mm-hmm. You know, his wisdom, his own struggles, his quirks.
Yeah. He seems like a very sweet man, and he's been asked to ask Will Light to do this, and he doesn't want to go back to the cardinal and say no, he doesn't want to do it, but he's trying to find this, how can I get him to do this? And he seems like a very patient man. Will does not have a lot of patience and is actually kind of rude to him at times, and in the end it is really Father Gervais that saves Will in a sense. I don't want to give anything away, but he's really key to Will finding himself through this.
That's the other thing that I think I have been writing about for a while in novels, thinly disguised, is what saves us. What are the things that are our lifelines in life? Some friendship or faith or humor or creating. You know, the role of creating and art, purpose. What are the things that save us?
Now, I'm not going to give it away, but when as you were doing this, did you know who the murderer was all along? It just happened.
I did not know.
You did not know.
And I had actually sent the first half of the book to my, for the first go-round, to my agent. And she called me and she said, all right, you just have to tell me what. Tell me the priest didn't do it, because if he did, I can't be your agent anymore.
That's funny.
Well, I never know. I think it was Doctorow. I know it was Doctorow who said when he wrote, he could only, it was like driving a car at night. He could just see as far as his headlights, but he knew he'd get to his destination originally. And that's my process as well. I never know where I'm going. I just have an idea or a character or a setting or a plot idea, and I start there, but I have no idea where it's going to go. I just have faith that at the end I'll reach the destination.
So you're like the readers in a sense that we're going, oh, and then you get to the end, you go, wow. So what's the reaction been? What's been the response from people? I know you've got a lot of nice reviews, but because it's grief is a hard thing for people, and I could see this being very helpful to some people. For others, maybe stirring up some of their own emotions.
Well, isn't that what books are supposed to do? Hopefully. Interestingly enough to me, some of the loveliest, most thought-provoking comments have been from readers who've lost a child. Mm. And I got a note the other day from someone whose priest is using it in his homily.
Oh, wow.
I got a beautiful comment on the publisher's website, and someone said, I don't know if this author has, this is very self-promoting, but I'm going to say it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this author has lost a child. If so, it's a very brave and profound book. If she hasn't lost a child, then it's a work of genius. Mm. And I thought, oh, I'll take that.
So tell us about the title, The Halo Effect.
Well, again, there's that, psychological name for something that we, when we look at other people, we ascribe by their look certain qualities to them. And so, and that's often been proven, like people are especially good looking, we ascribe them to be a better person than perhaps they are with no other evidence except their looks. And so when Will was looking at people in town as the potential murderer of his daughter, he saw them through those eyes. Mm-hmm. But when he started to look at them as the saints he was painting, he saw them through different eyes, because having them pose with their hands in prayer and with the veil and all, he started to look at them with a halo effect.
Yeah.
And how do we do that in life? How do we decide who is worthy and who isn't? We project on them.
Yeah. I was going to say one other thing. I've noticed a lot of readers, you know, the Amazon reviews, a lot of them, great ending. Great ending. That's all we're going to say about it. Anne LeClaire, her new novel is The Halo Effect. It's good to see you. Thanks, Anne, for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up after a break, historic restaurants of Cape Cod.